Welcome to Valley View Church's podcast. We hope this message encourages you. For more information about our church, check us out at vvchurch.org.
Well, that's a lot for starting together. It feels heavy. It feels heavy to me personally. I think that song, too, especially, break up the ground of all my traditions, of all my religion. In our yard this week, we're looking at the foulness of the yard. The grass is not growing, and you got to break that up. That compacted, hard soil, it's got to be broken up for life to come into it. And it's the same here. And so that's our prayer. That's our posture coming into the service. Lord, do what you got to do here. It's the same with me as well. I'm praying that over my own heart. And it's part of the reason, as I think about Valley View, I'm so grateful for so many who have been here over the years, who have stayed, who have remained, who have endured, who have endurance, who have longevity. In fact, I love that this was a draw for us to come back to our home, was that my kids can be around their grandparents. And I know there's a number of multi-generational families here and across the generations. You can see, I remember when God did this, I can project hope to the future generations. God's still at work, even in the midst of tragedy. In fact, I remember growing up, my grandmother, my mom's mom, I loved having to be able to visit with her. She just lived up near Indianapolis, not too far away, and she was a widow at the time. And until my brothers were born, I was her only grandchild. So I got all the attention until they ruined it, messed everything up. Thanks, Mom. But she was, one of her phrases that I loved, here was her phrase, let me get my purse. If I wanted to go somewhere and do something, let me get my purse. She was always eager to go. One of the funny things about her that we joked about was that she drove at the same speed everywhere. It was 35 out of the driveway or 35 on the interstate. It didn't matter. She had one speed in the car, which was interesting, but she was a great lady, loved on me well. And when she passed, she was 93 years old. Yeah, and what was interesting, I remember that day that she passed. I was teaching at a campus, teaching with Campus Crusade, but we were at a college campus, and I was there teaching with a number of other guys who we were all teaching various aspects of this one Bible study course. And I shared with the guy who was over the whole thing, I said, hey, by the way, my grandmother, she passed away yesterday. And he said, man, sorry to hear that. Now, that session we're going to teach this afternoon, he didn't even miss a beat. He just kept going on with business. And that's always stuck with me. I thought, man, at least act like you care for a second, you know? And of course, I thought, how many times have I done that in that moment? Have I been that, like, just totally locked in on my task, not even thinking about the person? The reality is, that's actually how the world happens. We hit trauma, we face something difficult in our lives, and even if people are, and I think most here, are very sympathetic, are very hurt with you, weep with those who weep. The reality is, though, the rest of the world moves on. That's just how it is. That's not right or wrong. That's just how it is. And yet, you might still be needing to wrestle with that trauma for a little bit or for decades. We're going to look at a passage today that was, I wasn't expecting to see this in this passage, and I really wasn't expecting for this to come on the heels of our city encountering just a number of tragedies this week. But we're going to look at John chapter 8, verses 12 through 30. And we're going to see in here what I think are five truths about how you move forward after trauma. In fact, I've started to read this passage through the lens. If you remember, a few weeks ago, we talked about the woman caught in adultery. And the way the passage goes is that after that, Jesus just continues to teach where he is. And we can't know for sure, but I got to wonder, if that woman is still there, how is this landing on her? How is this section that we're going to look today, after she has just been through horrendous trauma? For all she knew, she was about to be executed. This was it. She's certainly outcast and accused by the supposedly spiritual leaders You're not even worthwhile for us to spend time dealing with your issues. We'd rather get rid of you. And here we have Jesus' teaching with her in the midst, and I think it was relevant for her if she were there. Again, we don't know for sure. But these five truths that we're going to see about how you move forward in the midst of trauma certainly would have applied to her, but I think it also applies to us today. So let's look in John chapter 8. We're going to start by reading verses 12 through 20. We're eventually going to work our way through verse 30, but I'm going to start with just these first eight verses, verse 12, John chapter 8. And if you have a church Bible, that's on page 840. If you don't have a church Bible, we'd love to put a Bible in your hands. I try to key in the passages I'm teaching from to the page numbers on the screen into that specific Bible we have out in the connection corner. Those are free for you. Feel free to slip out and grab one at any time. But John chapter 8, verse 12. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." So the Pharisees said to him, "You are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true." Jesus answered, "Even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I come from and where I am going, but you do not know where I come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true. For it is not I alone who judges, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me." They said to him, "Therefore, where is your Father?" Jesus answered, "You know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would also know my Father." These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him, because his hour had not yet come. So what we're going to see here as we work through this passage are five truths on how to move forward after trauma. And by the way, I'm not commenting on the timing of that, depending on the depth of the trauma. It may be something you move forward past very quickly. It may take years. It may take decades to continue to work through on a much more deeper, life-altering trauma. So take this and apply it to where you are. But I think we see here five truths for how to move forward after trauma. And by the way, I'm going to spend most of our time on the first one, and then we'll motor through the last four. So don't get nervous when we're only halfway through the message and we've only finished point one. But this first one here comes up in verse 12 because Jesus starts this whole section with a pretty bold statement. Chapter 8 is one of these longer discourses, these dialogues that he has in most of Scripture. The whole long passage is back and forth, back and forth, back and forth for the whole chapter. And it actually makes it really hard to teach, because he keeps repeating themes over and over again, which is a good thing to do when you want to emphasize something, but it's hard to keep the topics interesting when the same ones keep coming up over and over again, and he's doing it because they're not getting it. And here he makes a very bold statement to start our time together. Jesus spoke to them saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." So this first truth for knowing how to move forward after trauma is to know where to find life. This is the first one of the five. Know where to find life. Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. I'm the light of life. Find life in me." After trauma, we often revert to things that we have thought at times have given us life. So someone shared with me recently, I had a rough week at work and did a lot of binge eating as a result to try to cope. Okay, maybe that's where you find life. Maybe it is in binge watching or binge napping, or who knows, maybe it's in, let me pour myself harder into work. I'm going to find significance there. I'll find life there. Maybe it's in isolation. I got to draw inward. I got to get away from everyone. Not saying all those things are inherently wrong, but we want to know where to find ultimate life, true life, because those things may give temporary life for sure. Where do we find true life? Jesus makes a bold claim. "I am the light of the world. I and in me, I'll have the light of life." So there's two phrases here that we're going to unpack for a session. We're going to have to stop down and maybe get a little technical for a minute. It's okay. It'll be good for us. He says, I am the light of the world. Or look at those two phrases separately. I am light of the world. Because we want to consider how this would have landed on the audience. How would they have heard what he is saying, specifically in that context? Every word is determined, the meaning of every word is determined by the context, about the words around it. It's like you've heard probably the phrase in real estate. How do you know the value of a home in real estate? It's location, location, location. That determines it all. You take the same home you live in here, drop it on the coast of California, it goes up 10 or 20x. So who knows? Depends where it is. Exact same house. You drop it in rural Arkansas, they'll probably pay you to move into it there. You know, it's like it completely changes the value depending on the location. Same thing with words. You see this phrase, I am, and it's incredibly common in the Bible. In fact, in these 19 or so verses we're going to look at, it shows up like a dozen times. I mean, at one level, it's just a phrase any of us use as a self-descriptor. I am hungry. I am tired. I am humble. Whatever, however you might use it, it's just a normal self-descriptor, a very common word. But words in certain contexts will have an elevated, a heightened, and altered meaning. So if I say to you, I'm on fire, you think he has a high estimation of himself and whatever I'm doing. If you're playing a basketball game, man, I'm on fire right now. Oh, yeah, maybe you're hitting a lot of shots in the row. Maybe things are going great for you. But if I stand up in a crowded audience with no other context and yell out the word fire, that's a dangerous thing to do. That has a completely different meaning. In fact, that's where free speech ends. You could be held liable for inciting a riot and any kind of damage that might come from that if it weren't true. And so when he stands up and says, I am the light of the world, that little phrase, I am, goes back to the whole Old Testament when they ask God, hey, when people ask who you are, what should I tell them? And he simply says, tell them I am. Tell them that there's no other way to describe me besides me just saying I am. Tell them that there's nothing else outside of me that can define me. Tell them that there's no other phrase, there's nothing that you can imagine that will fully describe how great I am. I just am. I just exist. I mean, this is so foreign to us to try to put our minds around that we've got to add, and of course he provides other names to help us, we've got to add other qualifiers to that. In fact, I remember if you were here 35 years ago, you might remember our big Jubilee celebration. Who remembers the year of Jubilee at Valley View? We had songs written about it. We had banners that would come up the aisles, these gigantic banners, and on these banners were phrases like, Jehovah Jireh, our provider. Jehovah Nisi, our banner. Jehovah Rapha, our healer. We have to have these additional phrases to understand the full complexity, and we still don't fully get it. But all he needs is, I am. I am self-sufficient. I'm completely independent. And so here we get, this is not Jesus making that claim yet. In fact, he says, I am the light of the world. He's not delivering the I am with that same weight, but he's hinting at it. And we're going to see it show up a few times in this chapter to where it does climax in a definite claim of deity, tying back into the Old Testament of God's own self-identification. So that's the first half of this phrase, I am the light of the world, and how we know where to find life. The second half, though, he says, I am the light of the world. We deal with I am, but also this light of the world. How would him saying, I'm the light of the world, fall on his audience? What would that mean to them? Of course, there's a whole old, we could walk through all of the Old Testament and look at all of the ways that light showed up, starting with the very first words of God. The very first words uttered, let there be light. I mean, he is the originator of the thing that literally brings life to our world. There would be no life without light. There would be no heat. There would be no energy. It would be utter devoid of life at every level. But there's a context here that is even more insightful in terms of how this would have fallen on them. Because the immediate context where he had been teaching was right at the close of the Feast of the Booths, Feast of the Tabernacles. And they had this practice, and we know this from Jewish writings that kind of come right after that time that sum up Jewish history. One of the practices they had was on that first evening of the Feast of the Tabernacles. In fact, in the treasury area, which it said in verse 20, he said these things, he spoke in the treasury area. The treasury was also located in what's called the court of the women, which meant that women and men would have been in this court area together. It would have been primarily just Jewish women. This would have been, and men, it would have been inside the court of the Gentiles. So no Gentiles would have been in this area as well. But one of the traditions they had was on that night, they would take these four gigantic lanterns and fill them with oil, gallons and gallons of oil. In fact, they were so huge for the wicks for these lanterns, they used the old clothing of the priests. That's how big these lanterns were. Imagine an old robe as a wick on a lantern you're going to burn. Gigantic lanterns, huge bright lights. And in fact, one of the other practices they had, and I don't know if this happened every year, but there was one leader in particular, Gamaliel. He was well known at the time. In fact, Paul references him and being an influence in his life. He had the practice of kind of joining in, and he had his own torches. He would carry 8 torches and would dance with them. Would even throw, in particular, was known for being able to throw one in the air, keep the others in his hand, not drop any of them. In fact, it was mentioned here in one of the commentaries I read that was on that background. He could even reach down, touch the ground, kiss the ground, never let a torch touch the ground at all. So I was thinking next year at Easter, maybe I get some of the elders to try that out. We could see if we kind of recreate that or not. Maybe not. The point is, why did they have all that light burning, glowing, bright in that moment? Part of the tradition, in fact, the Feast of the Tabernacles, the Feast of the Booths, was all about remembering God took us out of slavery in Egypt. He brought us back to Israel. He protected us along the way. And all along the way, there was a pillar of fire guiding them, a pillar of light guiding them. And by burning these gigantic torches, by celebrating light, they were saying, God, thank you for guiding us. Thank you for being the one who led us along the way. And in the midst of all that, Jesus stands up and says, I am the light of the world. I am. That pillar that guided you in the wilderness, I am the light of the world. This is where you will find real life. And so when we think about moving forward in the midst of trauma, go to the source of true life, of real life. Move towards Christ to find life. Keep moving toward Him. He's where real life is going to be found. Easy to say, right here on the stage, on a nice Sunday morning. But we have to sing louder than our unbelief. We say this now so that when trauma comes, we can proclaim it. We can remind ourselves. We can say, no, even if I don't feel it right now, real life is found in Him, and I'm going to move toward that. So that's the first truth towards how we find real life, how we move forward in the midst of trauma. Now, it's interesting the way they respond to this. So they hear Jesus' claim, and here's what they say in verse 13. They said, the Pharisees in particular, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. So, fair enough, they're citing Old Testament law here where you need at least 2 witnesses to, in that case, condemn someone of something, but even to prove anything true. You can't just go on your own word. You need to have multiple witnesses, which is real interesting that they want to get technical about the law right here with him. They weren't too interested in that earlier when they were ready to put him to death, and Nicodemus was like, don't we have a process? And they were like, get it, you know, do you believe in him too? Get out of here. Oh, that wasn't convenient. But now we do want to make sure to bring up the law, make sure everything's covered right. In response to that, Jesus has three arguments. And so look at verse 14. Here's the first one. Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true. For I know where I came from and where I am going, but you do not know where I come from or where I am going. The first thing he says is, I do bear witness about myself. I can bear witness about myself. Of course, this doesn't hold any weight for them yet. Of course, they don't care. They're just telling him, you can't bear witness about yourself. No, I can. They probably could have gone back and forth like that forever. Yes, I can. No, you can't. Yes, I can. You've been in those arguments, right? But he says, no, I can bear witness about myself. And this points to a greater reality about who Jesus is, about who God is, that some of those great things in life ultimately land at a place where you can say nothing else than because. It's self-existence. If you tell me, prove that the sun is true, prove that there really is a sun, I'll say stare at it, right? You'll learn real quickly. In fact, I'm always fascinated when there is an eclipse and, you know, every scientist you never heard of gets on NPR and says, hey, don't look at the eclipse. You'll burn up your retinas. You'll never be able to see again. And of course, afterwards, you always hear the report of that one guy, you know, out at the lake. He just had to look up. They didn't believe him. Some things are just self-attesting. We don't need the scientist to tell us that the sun exists. The sun is there. The sun is real. The sun is true. This is the big fancy theological word for this with God is his aseity. Aseity, A-S-E-I-T-Y. His aseity, his complete, utter independence, his absolute self-existence. He doesn't need anything else or anyone to be better than he is, to be more complete than he is. He didn't create us because he had something missing in himself and he needed us to fulfill it. No, he's utterly independent, absolute, complete in himself. And so Jesus literally is the one person that can make this claim. I can testify to myself. I really can. You may not agree, but I can bear witness to myself. So that's the first. Second, he says, is you judge wrongly. Look at verse 15. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. But yet, even if I do judge, my judgment is true. For it is not I alone who judge, but I am the Father who sent me. So he says, even if I do bear witness about myself, my judgment is true and yours is flawed. Yours is rooted in the flesh. Mine is rooted in something otherworldly. And we've all been in this situation where you're stuck in a perspective and you can't see outside of it. It could be in an argument with someone else. It could be something theological. It could be something scientific or metaphysical. But you're stuck in a realm where you can't see outside of that. I think back before 9/11, no one could have imagined that someone would use an airplane, a commercial airplane, as a weapon. That was, maybe there was a few people that had contemplated that, but outside of the normal realm, you knew terrorists hijacked planes, you knew they used weapons, but you put the two together, our minds didn't go there. And he's saying, you're trying to judge me, but your perspective is locked into the flesh. You can't see out beyond that. You can't see the reality of who I am. And then last, he says, verse 17 and 18, in your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I'm the one who bears witness about myself, which he already made statement about, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. So he's saying, I do have two witnesses. I have myself, and I have the Father above. In fact, when this occurred, it doesn't show up in the book of John, but it shows up in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Jesus is baptized, and the Father, the voice from above, says, this is my Son in whom I'm well pleased. This is the one I have sent. And so Jesus says to them, you don't have the full picture. You don't understand.
I can bear witness about myself. Your perspective is limited, and the Father has borne witness about me.
Makes a pretty good case, but again, they have a response. In response to that, look at verse 19. They said to him, therefore,
where is your Father?
Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. So in response to him saying, my Father bears witness about me, they say, where is your Father? Who, in fact, it's a little bit of, who is your Father? And I think a little bit of what is going on here very clearly is attacking his lineage. Surely it was no hidden secret. People could do math. Okay, Mary, Joseph, we know Joseph's not your daddy. That little secret, you tried to keep it, but you couldn't. So where is your Father? Who is this supposed guy that could stand up and testify on your behalf? And what they're doing, it's unfortunate that it's so powerful to bring up stuff people can't control to shame them. Of course, it didn't apply to Jesus. They thought it did. But you've experienced this too. It's no different than someone saying, putting you down because of your skin color. You know, because of your lineage, you can't be this. Or your height, or whatever. Some physical attribute you had nothing to do with. Maybe it's your hair color. Or maybe it's the lack of hair. I don't know. Okay? But for whatever reason, vilifying someone, putting them down, saying because of something you had no control over, none of us chose our biological parents, you had no part in it, you had no say. And because of that, you're worthless. People love to do that. And it shouldn't, and actually we should be able, because it's so meaningless at one level, we should be able to laugh it off, but it hurts. It works. And they know that. They at least think that'll just completely trip up Jesus. Yeah, we really know where you're from. Their intent is to shame him, to continue to ridicule, continue to put down. But he doesn't. He's not tempted by that. And the whole point of this first point is, I am the light of the world. I am where life is found. Come to me. In me you'll find life. So that's the first of the five truths. I told you we'd spend the longest time there, okay? We're going to keep motoring through the next four a lot more quickly. Four truths and four more truths for moving forward in the midst of trauma. So the first one was nowhere to find real life. The second is found in verse 19. Look back at that. They said to him, where's your Father? He said, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. Jesus responds to their question about the Father by giving a contrast. And it's setting up the reality of, if you want to move forward in the midst of trauma, here's the second point, know the Father. Know the Father. Because there's a huge difference between knowing of someone and knowing them. And this is the contrast he's setting up here. You say you know the Father, but you don't really know him. There's a huge contrast. I've shared the illustration before of going down to my dad's law office. He was an attorney. They had this beautiful old historic office building right next to the Center for the Arts down on Main Street. And in college, I loved to go down there and pretend to say, hey, Dad, how you doing? And really just asking for money and him not realizing it. But he probably did realize it, but didn't let on. And either way, I loved going down there. And what I loved is when I went in the front of that office building, there's a secretary there to guard people from coming in. And all I said was, I'm going up to see my dad. I know him. He's my Father. I'm going to see him. I don't need to stop and check with you because I know my Father. Those who just know of him have to stop with her, have to get approval to go on. There's a big difference between knowing of someone and knowing them. And Jesus makes an even bolder claim. To get to know my Father, the one you think you know, there's only one way. It's got to come through me, he says. To know the Father, you got to know me. And the takeaway for us as we think about moving forward in the midst of trauma, when I say know the Father, it's a really difficult phrase to just drop in a mixed audience because I don't know everyone's background with their father. And our perception of a heavenly father is deeply rooted in our perception of an earthly father. And so if you had a rough situation there, it's going to be hard to see him as he really is, which is perfect, loving, unconditional, comforting, accepting. Yes, he holds to a high standard. But when it comes to loving you like a father should, he is perfect. And so part of moving forward is in the midst of trauma is coming to that perfect, unconditional, comforting love, embracing that, accepting that, knowing that, meditating on that, dwelling on that every day. In the midst of feeling like the world is over, come and find hope and love and comfort and peace and acceptance in him. Know the Father. So that's the second. Let's look at the third. The third truth and how you move forward after trauma. Look at verse 21 and 22. So he said to them again, I'm going away. You will seek me. You will die in your sin. Where I am going, you cannot come. So the Jews said to him, will he kill himself since he says, where I am going, you cannot come? So Jesus says, I'm going away. Where I'm going, you can't come. It confuses them. The key takeaway for us here, the third point of moving forward after trauma is know where you are going. Have assurance of where you are going. Have focus on where you are going. A journey is brought great definition by knowing your destination. Of course, there's fun in just hopping in the car and going wherever. But there's something about knowing where I'm going to end up that brings focus. It brings purpose. It brings dedication in the midst of that. So know where you are going. And Jesus says, I know where I'm going, but you don't. Now, this confuses them because we saw at the end of chapter 7, or in the middle of chapter 7, he kind of said the same thing. I know where I'm going, you don't. And at the time, they thought, where's he going? Is he going to the diaspora? Is he going to the Gentiles? He must be going somewhere where we would never go. Okay, we'd never go there. We're here in Jerusalem. We're in the best place to be. Why would we go out into other places where they're far from Jerusalem? So he repeats it. So they go, it must not be that. Now they're thinking, what's he going to do? Kill himself? Another place we wouldn't go. We wouldn't dare do that because that's a sure way, at least in their mind at the time, to separate themselves from God forever. That was their understanding. That was their conviction. In fact, they held to that so tightly. I brought in a book, this is actually my grandmother's copy of Josephus. You may be familiar with his name. He's an ancient historian. In fact, a lot of what we know about the culture at that time, about the Jewish culture at that time, is based on Josephus' writings. He was a general in Jewish army. He had much influence at a lot of levels. And a lot of people, if you would have gone to people's homes for years before books were more prevalent, they would have had a copy of the Bible and a copy of Josephus. This copy in the front has like all kinds of family heritage. It's written, looks like 1854 is when someone first wrote their name in the front. The cover's fallen off of it. But Josephus was this ancient historian. He didn't start that way, though. He started as a war general. And so when Rome came to fully take over Israel and they were fighting back, he was a general over a city. The city gets captured, and he and some of the other army generals, lieutenants, they all hide out in a well under the city because they think, hey, these guys will come in, they'll think we left, and they'll leave, and we'll be able to escape. But the Romans know they're there. And so they're walking around the city for days. We know you're here, Josephus. Here's all we're going to do to you when we find you. You and your guys are hiding out. We know you're here. We know you didn't make it out. We're going to find you. And here's how we're going to torture you. Here's the parts of your body we're going to cut off. Here's the parts, the ways we're going to burn you over and over again. They're hearing this for days. And they're so dedicated to not taking their own lives, they come up with this plan. We don't want to go through that. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take turns killing one another. And then we get down to the last two guys. The two of us will just kill each other at the same time. So none of us have to take our own lives. So they start out with the first guy. Guy kills him, then the next guy kills him. They work their way. They get down to the last two. And Josephus is like, you know what? Maybe we don't do this. Okay? Maybe we do surrender and see what happens. I got some things I think I can offer that'll keep them from killing us. All that to say, don't ever go along with that plan, by the way. Real convenient for him, but absolute commitment. No way we take our own lives. No way. They're looking at Jesus going, but that must be what he's talking about. And Jesus says, no, look, you got to know where you're going. And part of moving forward in the midst of tragedy, in the midst of trauma, know where you're headed. Continue to dwell on the reality that you are secure in him, that your ultimate destination is in him, that your ultimate meaning in life comes from knowing him and being rooted in him. So that's the third truth. Know where you're going. And then the fourth, verse 23 through 27, know where you are from. Know where you're going. Know where you're from. Look at verse 23. He said to them, you are from below. I am from above. You are of this world. I am not of this world. I told you you would die in your sins, for unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. So they said to him, who are you? Jesus said, what I've been telling you from the beginning. I have much to say about you, much to judge. But he who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him. In the midst of this, they did not understand that he had been speaking to them about the Father. So, know where you're going, know where you are from, just as there is great confidence in knowing your destination on a journey. There's also tremendous confidence in knowing your roots, your foundation, the thing that connects you to the rest of the world, the thing that gives you a base to stand upon. Know where you're going and know where you're from. He says to them, you're from the world. I'm from a different place. Your values, again, are rooted in worldly values. Mine are rooted in otherworldly values. Mine are rooted in the values of Scripture. And when our values are rooted in the world, we act different. In fact, I was meeting with Mike Bell this week. Mike Bell's been a member here for quite a while. He's involved in a lot of different areas of the church. And Mike was sharing some of his testimony with me, and it was really powerful. I love hearing people's testimonies about how God worked in their life. But one of the things he said that really was interesting, he said, let me tell you, before I knew Christ, I had the biggest temper. I had the biggest issue. So this morning I was like, hey, do you care if I share this? And his wife Lynn was like, let me tell you, it was true. Okay. He'd flip over couches. He'd run outside yelling stuff. The neighbors would be like, what's wrong with that guy? Big temper. And of course we all, even Mike would say, hey, there's times where that temper wants to flare up again, but it's not the same anymore. I don't have to make a big show to try to get my way. My whole world doesn't unravel when the smallest little thing occurs. Again, he's not perfect. I'm not perfect. None of us are perfect. But it's a completely different reality when your place where you are from is the world versus Christ. It changes your perspective on everything. And that's important when you encounter trauma. I don't have to react like I used to. I don't have to assume the world is over, even though it feels like it, even though it certainly feels like it. I'm not minimizing that reality. It definitely feels like it. There's going to be ups and downs in the midst of moving forward, by the way. It's not apply these five principles and it's done. No, that's naive. But know where you're from. That's another key truth in moving forward in the midst of trauma. And then lastly, number five, know your purpose. Jesus gives two purposes here. Look at verse 26. He says, I have much to say about you and much to judge, but he who sent me is true, and I declare to the world what I have heard from him. Part of his purpose, his first purpose, was to continue to declare who the Father is to the world. But then second, he says, look at the rest of the verses. They did not understand he had been speaking about the Father. So Jesus said to them, when you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he,
and that I do nothing on my own authority, but I speak just as the Father taught me. And he who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone. I always do the things that are pleasing to him. And so Jesus mentions at least two purposes here. We could unpack dozens probably in this section. One being, I continue to declare who my Father is to the world. And the other here is to be exalted, to be honored, to be glorified. And so when I think about those five truths and our know your purpose, part of our purpose, and there is great power in focusing on the needs of others in the midst of our own trauma. We can't just give till we're empty, but there's something about that in the midst of that that helps us move forward, especially when it is focused on caring for others, ministering to others. I know some of the people that I've leaned on the most to help others in the midst of tragedy have been through it themselves. You never know how God is going to use the trauma you've been through to help someone else to get through it. That doesn't make it easy in the moment. But focus on the purpose he has for you in the midst of moving forward. And when I think of all these five truths, I go back to thinking about that woman caught in the midst of adultery at the beginning that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. How would this have fallen on her? And those men who drug her out there are saying to her, you deserve to die. But she hears from Jesus, I am the light of life. She hears from them, you've ruined a family with your adultery. How dare you? Jesus says, in me, you find life, and in my Father, you find your true family. Know your Father. They say to her, actually, because of your actions, you're worthless. You have no worth to us. But Jesus says, I have a purpose for you. Jesus says, I'll keep using you, even in the midst of your trauma, even though it's hard to see in the moment. And I think he would have said to her there, I'm not done with you yet. Go and sin no more. I'm not done with you yet. And I think he could say to us, I'm not done with you yet. He's going to say it to us collectively. He's going to say it to us individually. He's not done with you yet. He's not done with you. And so whatever you've been through, and I know our city has hit a heavy trauma this week, and I'd encourage you to focus on those five truths for moving forward in the midst of trauma. Let's pray. God, we thank you that we can gather in the midst of a heavy week. And we don't always feel your presence right next to us. There are days where we wonder, are you there? Lord, help us to focus on the truth of who you are, even in the midst of the heaviness, of the weightiness. And I thank you for Andrew's prayer this morning, the declaration that this will be a city of peace. And the only way for this city to know peace is to know you. And Lord, help us to declare you to all of those around us this week in a way that, of course, is appropriate depending on where they are. But help us to be able to shine the light of who you are into this world who desperately needs you and desperately needs peace. Thank you for so many who come, Lord. Help us to know your peace today. We love you, Jesus. Amen.